Okay. So thank you very much for giving an opportunity to give this Blackboard seminar. I mean, it's a bit unusual. I wanted to start off with some videos because those of you who are not familiar with development, which is the subject of my talk today, might have a difficulty capturing some of the essential features that are going on there. So I'll start with a few videos which will allow me to illustrate some key notions in development. And then the structure of my talk is going to be pretty much about 10 minutes of history. So you know what are sort of the historical roots to what I will mention today. And then there will be about half of my talk devoted to, as the title of my talk refers to the information that is basically used and produced during development to actually lead to this remarkable phenomenon. And then another part of the talk will be dealing with the sort of output of this information, which is to some extent the mechanical properties of tissues and how forces are being produced to shape animals. So just to start with, I would like to show you a video of, so development is a story of how an egg, such as this one, a single cell, becomes an animal. So you will not see the animal that emerges from that. But what you can appreciate is some stuff going on here. The cell divides. So that's a few minutes after the Big Bang, I would say. You know, one cell, and then you have two. And then you have these two cells, which you see are in contact. And, you know, more cell divisions go on. And you will see now we have four cells. We don't quite see all of them. But soon you will see now these two cells on this side now dividing again. So you see, biology is simple. It's multiplication. You start with one cell, and you have exponential cell division. And if you have growth that sustains this process, and if it was infinite, you know, you would soon, and you can make the math as I talk, have a gigantic problem of having too many cells. So there has to be some kind of stationary phase where the number of cells that are produced and the disappearance of some cell by cell death, or actually an arrest of growth, is what actually leads to the fact that we human beings, but any organism, has a finite size. And I think this allows me to establish two key notions in development, at least three. One is that you start with a single cell, which is going to divide by a process known as cell division. And this gradual process of cell division gives rise to tissues, which are assemblies of cells. And you could see cells as the essential bricks of animals, tissues as sort of an intermediate scale, and then you have the final organisms. Of course, tissues could be like assembled into an organ, which has a dedicated function. And so you will hear a lot about cells, the division, their assembly into tissues. You see, at the end of this movie, you have a single layer all around, surrounding kind of a hollow sphere. So there's some liquid inside, right? So, and I'll come back to that in a few seconds. The other important notion is that, and maybe we can see this movie again, is that at the beginning you have one single cell division and then producing two cells. Later on you have four cells. And you will notice something really remarkable, that all the cells divide with a very precise orchestration, if you wish. They divide synchronously, and we'll probably see it in a couple of seconds when these cells are going to divide sort of perpendicular to this plane.
What's the real time scale?
Yeah, what is the time
scale? So I'm sorry I don't have the time scale, but I would believe it is, you know, I would give an order of magnitude. Well, but I don't think this is real time, but it's few minutes. Well, it's probably a few minutes or a few tens of minutes. In some other organism that I know better, it could be as fast as 8 minutes. And I don't think it could be any faster than that. In human beings, you know, there's during division, there's many things going on. You need to duplicate the genetic material, which takes a lot of time before you divide. And that sort of is the sort of phase in which sort of time, how fast cells can divide. And then you have this complicated process, very beautiful, which I will not talk about, where actually you partition this into the two daughter cells equally. But you see how perfectly symmetric and regular this process is. And there could be variation on the theme. If you have this other video, you will see that sometimes cells divide differently. Instead of being clipped symmetrically, here you have one cell, like a zipper, right? This is going to give rise to some not so familiar animals called Cnidophora. Doesn't matter. I mean, these are all marine animals. But the fact is that it's very symmetric, it's very orchestrated. So there has to be a very precise level of information that is produced and interpreted by these cells to give rise to this very highly orchestrated, robust process of cell division. And anything pretty much that I will talk about later in my talk suggests a very high degree of control over the cell biological processes. And so that's why, you know, just looking at these movies, which if you have a sense of beauty, which I'm sure you do all have, you could spend a lot of time looking at this. And I think any naive person, maybe a child would be the right test, would say, well, there must be something going on that tells the cells when to do what they do, right? And also, because you see the cells dividing, there must be some force squeezing them. And of course, no one does it. They have to do it by themselves. So that allowed me to introduce this very important notion of information, which we'll have to elaborate upon and say, what is this information? How does it work, etc., etc.? And also, seeing the cells dividing, there has to be some forces that are produced and controlled to basically tell the cells when, how they divide, and we'll see other active processes going on development, which also, because they are endowed with motility and movement, requires some source of energy and force production. So that's why, in the second half of my lecture, I will talk about mechanics, right? So,
how long does it appear to go on as if they were simultaneous?
It's a very good question. I think as long as there's a symmetry in the animals, and as long as there are maybe less than 100 cells, there would be very high control over the synchrony. But now these are also very special animals, which have this very remarkable degree of precision and reproducibility in the pattern. There are other organisms in which I think you would soon diverge from this very close synchrony. The truth is that, you know, there is not such a thing as, you know, a zoo of 100 organisms in which all of these features have been studied very well. And actually, this allows me to tell you that the reason why we actually today can give a lecture on development is because we have so-called model organisms, which are these special animals. They are not more special than anything else, except that we can do experiments on them, we could look at them, we can quantify the inner workings of these cells and organisms in amazing quantitative details. And the reason why today we have this workshop run at KITP, and there have been a few in the past, is because precisely we can now describe in quantities that actually underlie development in such a way that you could really understand them much better, have hypothesis tests them against quantitative data. When it used to be, and it will be apparent in the next few minutes while I go back in history, that the process could be, you know, was very qualitative. Now, the remarkable thing that few qualitative data could nonetheless make some very important hypotheses which have really influenced history of science, at least of life science. So there's no general how precise this is going to be. It's really dependent on organisms. So, you know, just the last video, a couple of last videos, here I've shown you cells, and already you have this notion of information and force going on. But now if you look at, not cells, but as I said, tissues, now instead of having one cell that you look at, you have 6,000 cells that are at the periphery of an embryo. This is the embryo of an insect called Drosophila. It's one of these model organisms that scientists work on. And if you look at it, you can see, well, some stuff going on. I will not describe it at the moment. But you can clearly see that, you know, a cell would be sort of a colon this size. You have 6,000 cells around. And the sort of envelope around the rugby ball is being reshaped to produce what would be the head to tail axis or anteroposterior axis, and then also dorsal ventral axis and any such sort of symmetry breaking that occur in an embryo. And so there again we have this issue that there must be some information that tells why that these cells and only these ones move toward this part, why these cells don't move. There's something going on here which is not visible, but some of these cells get inside the embryo. So there's a lot of things going on, and there again must be some information as well as mechanical forces being produced to actually control the orchestration of this phenomena. And there again, if you look at many embryos, you would find that this process is highly reproducible. You could also look actually at other insects, other flies. It's amazing to see how this stage of development has not changed in evolution, because if you take, you know, 10 different flies, even mosquitoes, you will find very similar development processes. And you know, the stability of these embryogenetic movements, you know, has been going on for millions of years when, you know, the Alps or other mountains have formed. So it gives you an idea of the stability of the genetic control over these processes. It's very precise, and the process can be very reproducible. So, a last video, and then is the development of zebrafish, which is a fish, and there you will see some very, again, precise. Do we have the video going on? Oh, it's because we're at the end, sorry. I will speed it up. So you see at the beginning you have these two cells. This is fat. This is a yolk of the egg. The cells divide up in a sort of cup in the sort of this part of the embryo. You can no longer discern the cells, but you have this tissue, this mass of cells. And soon you will see the cells actually moving like a cap around the head, moving, spreading, if you wish, like honey on a ball over the embryo. These are sort of the movement of the tissue. So it's like a big envelope around yolk. And then you have sort of this band around. The head would be somewhere here, the posterior tail here. And you will see progressively this so-called anterior posterior axis forming. In a few seconds, you will see, well, this fat thing here, which is the head forming. And then you will see segmentations, which are the so-called structures, which look like iterated patterns. So, you know, within a few hours, you have this remarkable phenomenon again of organization of an otherwise initially very symmetric structure. Okay? So, I think that again, at the level of tissues, you can come up with the idea that there must be some information going on, and there must be some mechanical features going on. And so, I will talk about these two issues. Now, I can switch that off. Oops. Thank you. So, I think you could start with and sort of a few minutes of history about when people could look at these few cells. There's a German biologist called Hans Driesch, who at the turn of the 20th century did very simple experiments. He was looking at sea urchin embryos. And if you take a sea urchin embryo at exactly the stage where you saw in the movie two cells being formed, he could take any of these two cells, separate it, and that would form a new organism. He could do it up to four, six cells or so. He could also dissociate the cells, reassort them randomly, and he could see that a normal animal would emerge out of this completely mixed group of cells. Normally, you have this very exquisite pattern of cell division. It looks so nicely pre-organized that you might think that if you perturb it, you will mess up the whole thing. But that was sort of the foundation of his experiments. He showed that when he did that for a few rounds of cell division, that didn't affect at all the developmental processes going on, which told him that besides being very precise and orchestrated, the information that was produced was not so rigid and confined to a certain pattern of division that, you know, like if you think of a car, there's a chain of decision in a factory. If you mess up one element, there's no repair unless you have human beings or smart programs to actually make checkpoints and repair the process. So for some time, people thought, you know, if you kill the cell, well, you would lose half of the embryo. And if you reshuffle the positions of cells, then you will mix up all the information and you would be dead. So there was a theory of another German biologist called Wilhelm Hoechs, who actually had this notion of mosaic development, which precisely stated that each cell is fated to a particular fate, as it's called, and if you messed up with this, then you would affect the whole pipeline of decision. Hans Driesch's experiment showed clearly that it was not the case, at least in searching in early development. So that actually sparked some battles between people, the mosaic versus the so-called inductive view of development. And actually this person, Hans Driesch, is the first one who has actually coined a very important set of terms that are used today in the context of stem cell, which is pluripotency, and totipotency. That cell that some cells are totipotent because they can make a whole animal if you separate it from the other ones. Of course, if you do the experiment progressively during development, you will enter a gradual step from inductive, pluripotent, to mosaic, no longer pluripotent state, right? So these, I think, are really very important experiments to know, even though they are very old. I mean, probably none of what we do today will have such a long-lasting life in history, but these experiments are truly important. So Hans Risch, unfortunately, was a sort of scientist who was, at the time, very much influenced by this view of so-called vitalist development. In other words, that there would be no chemical, physical basis, that there was something of another kind that we knew at the time of chemistry and physics that could explain this phenomenon. And one of his disciples, called Hans Spemann, another important name, also sort of adhered to this vitalist view of development. So these two people had a major influence in development, and I will elaborate on one of these experiments from this guy. But in the end, and we'll see how important that discovery were, I mean, already I've said something quite important, but Spemann refined that quite drastically. They couldn't come up with a mechanism because they felt that there was something non-chemical that would underlie these processes. So I would like to say a few words about Spemann and what he did. He did an experiment in frogs. So at the stage when the frog is no longer a single cell, but a mass of cells called blastula, where you actually have, you know, a layer of cells all around and some kind of cavity inside. And so you can look at the animal. This is the North Pole, and this is the South Pole. And here you have a band of cells, or a region, if you want, in the embryo. And it's this region, right, which he took away from the frog and grafted in another frog, embryo at the same stage, and put it there, opposite. Normally, in the normal embryo, something special goes on, these cells get inside, migrate, and form an anterior posterior axis pretty much like what you've seen on the video. You remember the zebrafish? It's not the same details, but the phenomenon is the same, that you have cells moving in and out, spreading and forming an anterior posterior axis. And you have a tadpole that comes out of it with a head and a tail and an eye. And so when he did this experiment of grafting this piece of cells into a donor embryo, he found that he could form Siamese embryos, so something like this. So that is quite remarkable, because I told him that at a stage where it's not just a few cells, but actually maybe 10 to the fourth, many, many cells, there's something special about this group of cells that allows to actually reproduce a new animal. And you know, these cells, okay, are only a tiny bit of the new axis. I don't know exactly where they are, okay? But it's just a tiny fraction. So it means that these cells must communicate with their neighboring cells and refate the neighboring cells to something different and effectively produce a new animal. So that gave rise to the concept of so-called organizer. Groups of cells in during development are actually fated to organize the neighbors in such a way that they can produce a new animal. Yes?
I'm slightly confused, because it seems like the first set of experiments suggests that all the instructions are inside one cell. Right?
Depends what you mean by information. But keep going.
Instructions of
sure.
How to divide, whatever, is sitting inside an individual cell. But then this is complicated, because now it's still one cell. So are you saying that
it's many cells here? So this group, it's a group of cell. Okay. So I think there's something common in these two experiments. Maybe I didn't explain properly, so let me do it again. Here, the sort of prevalent idea at the time, at least those of Hooke's, was that this cell has some information, keeps it, and cannot change its mind. It's locked in certain fate. And it's locked, so it means whatever this one cell
so
does.
It also has all the future unfolding information
right.
Propagated. That's a full sequence.
Right. But you see, the fact that these cells would be locked in, cannot change its mind, means that the neighboring cells cannot talk to it, or if it talks to it, it wouldn't change its fate. So there has, as a correlate of that theory, it said that, you know, you're locked in, you have a program, you don't change, and you don't talk to your neighbors, right? So Hans Risch experiments where he showed that actually he can refate Well, actually, that scrambling around the cells or cutting in two halves at some stage didn't change the outcome. So that these cells, whichever number of cells they are, have some kind of self-organization property. And self-organization among cells maybe hints at the idea that there could be some information between the cells exchange. I don't think he actually quite talked about that. But Spemann, in a way that is more, you know, explicit, clearly suggested the idea of information being produced by a group of cells being exchanged with their neighbors so as to reorganize development. So I think there is a common theme there, the idea of induction, that group of cells can talk to their neighbors, that they produce and exchange information in order that it could organize development. So here we are in 1926, 1924, the key experiment. So actually it's not Spemann, it's also Otto Mangold, his PhD students who was very important in this experiment. And they got the Nobel Prize in 1926 or 28. She did experiments, but you know, you're...
She didn't get the Nobel Prize.
Right, she didn't get the Nobel Prize. That's a shame. That's a reason.
But she prized, fortunately, in the British Journal.
Right. So, you know, it's so-called the Spemann organizer. There are some reviews that said the Mangold and Spemann organizer. Anyway. So I think here the important thing is that these two people really identify the notion of information and organizing function. And so the problem that these people were vitalists, so they thought that if there was anything down there, I mean, how could you access it scientifically? Well, the good thing is that, you know, time went on. And as you know, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, there's been this revolution in life science where actually people got a chemical understanding of this information that is produced in cell, the DNA information, the genetic information, and how all of this is actually producing protein, which are the tools used to organize development. So precisely in the 70s, it became possible using to actually have molecular access and chemical understanding of what happens in development. And that's why, you know, in the 80s, 90s, and still now, there's been a major revolution in life science through the modern chemical understanding of how development goes on. And that I would like now to sort of give you an overview of the key notions that scientists are today addressing in development. Before I go into that, I want to make sure that we are all on the same page with regard to the information. We all know that there are genes in organisms. Let's say these genes form a collective of information, which you could call it as a hardware. But now, of course, in any single, and we typically in any organism, you have a range of 10 to 20, at most 30,000 different genes, right? And in any cell, not all these genes will be activated, only a tiny fraction of them. So expression of a gene, which I may use at some point in my lecture, is actually referring to the fact that the softwares are usually off, but sometimes they're activated. So the information that they contain in principle is being activated. In chemical terms, that means that the gene, which is a piece of DNA, is going to produce a messenger called RNA. It's a messenger that is then used as a transient information to make the protein. So so you have a gene, which I call with an arrow, that produces a messenger. So this is stable. This is segregated and descending, you know, a split in the daughter cells. This thing is transient and used to make the protein. Proteins are the chemical species that actually make functions. You know, they could be producing forces that we'll talk about later, or actually being involved in the regulation of these genes. So there's been some fundamental understanding of gene regulation in the 70s by studying much simpler organisms in the development. But later on, in the 80s, it became possible to actually describe the information that underlies development in terms of regulation of genes by the very protein that they produce. So think of development and information in it as a set of genes that is being activated in time and space following sort of a program. You could call it a program of development that tells, in this cell, at this time, in this position, I'm going to activate this set of genes. And this is going to have consequence because, of course, these genes produce messengers and proteins which themselves are going to interact with the neighbors. Of course, the complexity is great, and maybe compared to black holes, it's more complex because you have infinite, many more, you know, degrees of freedom because you have many more molecules being produced, and they can interact with so many different molecules. But the good news is that, in spite of being complicated, and I think this is a major thing that I want to say today, it is possible to actually crack some things which have looked mysterious for many years, and actually even important developmental biologists were stuck in vitalist views because they didn't think this was possible to describe development in these terms. And I will try to rapidly tell you that we can do this today, and that's good news. Okay? So, time. Good. It doesn't matter if I have to speed up. So, what I would like to do at this point is, talking about information, is so the key questions about the information is, what is this information? How is it interpreted? So the information, what is this information? What information? The interpretation of this information. How does it spread in the tissue? So how can cells talk to the neighbors? How does it spread? Because the genetic information is stuck in the cell. But if the cells talk to the neighbors, as Spemann suggested, well, they have to produce some signals. And you know, in what sense is this an information? What kind of information? Well, and so it's important to realize that back in the 60s, it was largely believed that all different organisms on Earth would have their own genetic makeup, and that there would be no commonalities between how you make a fly and how you make a human being. The reason why is that although we knew there was some information, I think the majority, if not 100% of the people, felt that, you know, there would be fly genes, there would be human genes. Of course, these genes would be important, but there would be no commonalities between the genes that we make and the genes that animals make. So if you study flies, then you might understand something about how you make flies, and that will have maybe some relevance to the understanding of how you make development, but it will have no relevance to understanding other organisms. And one of the major things that happened actually in the 80s when people began to clone genes, that is, identify the genes responsible for development, they discovered that actually the genes were highly conserved, massively conserved. Actually, there are a few Nobel Prize in developmental biology, but the, I think, only one between 1928 and maybe one Nobel Prize after was in 1995, by people working on flies who identified some very important genes responsible for development. And the reason why they had the Nobel Prize is also because not only because they cracked sort of the underlying logic about development, they also actually found that the genes, well, or the community after them, found that the genes that they had identified in flies actually were conserved in other animals. In other words, that there was something general about the information. And I think this is a very important step to find out that, of course, now we understand this, and this is obvious, or maybe none of you find it obvious, but at least it seems obvious that the information is shared because there's common ancestries for evolution, and therefore the information was there in the ancestor and then basically evolved and diverged. But this is, so I think this is important to realize that this information is conserved, and that's, of course, a very important step. There's a conservation of the components, and I think this is a very important realization. Now, the second very important realization is that about the interpretation of this information, how does it spread, and a few things that I will illustrate in the next few minutes. Well, there is a certain logic to how it works. The problem is that when you study in organisms, you have many genes, you are maybe dealing with organism-specific processes. The question is there something general and logical? Is there something biologic, in a sense? And, you know, sometimes we biologists are stuck with the notion that an important gene is a gene that is conserved from, say, flies to humans. And sometimes you have a non-conserved gene that is very important for flies. And there's a good example of that I will talk in a few minutes. And this, you know, some people, skeptical, would say, well, but that's a fly-specific gene. It doesn't explain how humans are formed. Well, I would argue, and I think many people argue, that the important thing is not so much the molecule, which is, serendipity of history and evolution, but rather the logic, if there is such a thing as a logic, that underlies development. So what I'd like to do now is not bore you with gene names, which is not really important. That's one of the virtues of these black box seminars. There's no name of genes. So we try to trim it down to important logical steps. Okay. Of course, when you do try to extract the logics, you simplify enormously. But that's the virtue also of our scientific approach, to simplify, to make sense of things. So what I would like to do now is not boring you with genes, but give you a few examples of how information is being interpreted and spread and exchanged within cells, and give you three examples of kinds of logic that can be used by cells in tissues to actually convey information and organize developments. And that would be sort of the modern translation of Spearman's earlier observation. Okay? If you have any questions, go. Keep going. Why not erase the, well, I will probably erase this. So,
is there a virtue of calling it information rather than instruction?
I think you can call it an instruction, and I think many biologists call it, instructions. People, the term that are used, have been used, are things like a cell is being determined, is being fated, the notion of information spread in a tissue is called patterning. These are terms used abundantly by people. I think in the end, it is information. I felt that the term would speak to people who don't necessarily understand the history and know the history, and therefore. And sometimes it's important to just realize it is information of a particular kind, but it is just information. So I would like to illustrate three different types of information or modalities in which information is being produced and exchanged between cells and tissues to actually control development. And in the Spearman experiment, you could see that these cells could reorganize the whole animal. So do they talk locally and by proxy? You send a message to your neighbors, or is it such a thing as someone lecturing and speaking at a distance and telling everyone in the audience, the tissue, what they should do? And if so, how would you in the front row know that the information is different from the people in the back? I can make it explicit in the content of my information, but cells only produce proteins and exchange with their neighbors. So how do they do it? Yes?
Sorry, you said that it repatterns the whole organism, but it doesn't produce like a differently oriented organism. There's some portion of the cell that don't get the message, right? Because they
Absolutely.
Stay in the old way
right.
as well.
Right. So of course, the cells around them have a certain degree of naivety. They can be reprogrammed. But of course, there is another sort of pre-organized, there's already another organizer here. So you cannot erase all that is around. Effectively, if the graft is done properly, the right stage and the right location, you could almost make a complete anterior axis. Sometimes it's just the head or a bit of the tail, and so on and so forth. And these are sort of, which I think suggest that indeed the effectiveness of the reprogramming depends on when and where you do it and how you do it, right? So the cells around it would have to be reprogrammed. But not all of them would do so. So there's a certain degree into which you could reorganize cells. Because at some point, cells will receive conflicting information. They're confused. I have information from here and there. What should I decide?
So he didn't remove the corresponding organizer?
No, he didn't. Not that I know.
One question. So when there are two heads, for instance, is the total number of cells always conserved? Like the head would be smaller than a rib than a normal?
I think it's pretty normal. It's a good question. The size is defined by how much the energy is in the form of food yolk that is in the egg. So that will have to be split in two. So I would argue that based on that, this would be smaller size than a normal, and it will split in two, right? Because they don't feed until the time they hatch, right? They use the energy store in the egg. And that's true of all so-called external development, where you partition the egg to make many cells, and the energy is in the egg, not on the outside. Only in mammalian organisms and other, do you actually feed the animal to make it grow, right? So three kinds of information, modalities of exchange in information. The first one is actually has a very weird name because It's not very explicit, but I will explicit it. It's a so-called morphogen. So it's the idea that a group of cells would produce a substance at a certain rate, which would diffuse and make a certain gradient of concentration in the tissue. The gradient could be of any shape, could be exponential, could be linear, doesn't matter, right? And that this is a distance in the tissue, right? So this is close to the source, and this is far away. And that if cells receive a high level of the concentration of the substance, M, then they will understand that they have to make, say, head. And if it's an intermediate concentration, then they would form gut. And here they would form nothing. I mean, this is a completely wrong example. But this important model, which actually was has history in long, you know, experiments in leeks and other organisms at the end of the 19th century, was popularized and framed very clearly by actually Lewis Wolpert, who gave the black belt seminar 2 years ago, who actually coined it the so-called French flag model, because here would be blue, white, and red. The idea that you go from continuous information in a field of cell to discontinuities in terms of gene expression. So all you ask is, I form a substance that would decay because of degradation and constant flux and so on and so forth. And there would be a mechanism whereby genes above a certain threshold would activate the blue genes, below white or red, and even below it would be red. So effectively, you would partition the field into discrete domains. And you see, you know, this is very simple. And the important thing is that there have been many examples of such things going on in development. That is true, for instance, of how you make an anteroposterior axis in the embryo. There's a molecule, doesn't matter, that forms a concentration gradient, lower concentration, and so on and so forth. And that effectively partitioned the embryo into different domains. And we had a couple of people actually giving talk in the past weeks about, even today, although this was discovered 20 years ago or more, I mean, there's a great deal of interest in this system, because here's a great system where you know the input information, you know the output, but questions are how precise can this system be? How reproducible can you tell cells in this tissue where they are? Think here of having across along this axis a few hundred cells. And there's going to be a gradient in this cell which is 0.5 millimeter in length. And if this mechanism works, you want to make sure that, well, the boundary of gene expression is not going to be ragged like this, which would be reflecting their inability to read concentration properly or the existence of an otherwise very irregular gradient. So here we have an opportunity to ask questions of how precise are the networks that actually provide and refine information to fate cells during development. Okay? Another example, very famous, is actually invertebrates in the so-called neurotube. So the neurotube in cross-section, this is a neurotube. You have these cells which would form the neurotube, and you have this group of cells here which produce a morphogen that forms a gradient of concentration along the ventral dorsal axis. And that has a very important output, which is defining, so here you will have neurons that are born, and the identity of these neurons, which reflects in the projection, okay, depend on how much concentration they receive from this signal. And so examples in invertebrates, the molecules are different. Of course, there will be details that are different. But one of the important things is that the logic that underlies this set of these developmental processes actually lies into the existence and functioning of these morphogens. There's great debate on how they form, how the information is interpreted, how robust or precise this information system is. This is one example. Second example.
Do the scales change with temperature? Like if you change external conditions, radiation, do you alter VWR?
This is a very good question. There's a great deal of interest in the scaling of this. Of course, fly eggs will not be, so I will answer your question by sort of putting in a broader context. Fly eggs have a certain size, let's say 0.5 millimeter, but also it may vary. And you could have fly strains with a certain, you know, those that we have in the lab that have certain size, and another flays that will be bigger. So the certain variability in the size of the egg would actually reflect how much food the mother put in the egg to make the egg. So what you want, if you are selecting an evolution, a mechanism of development that would be giving proportions, is actually to have this information system to scale with size. And I think most morphogen systems seems to be scaling processes, that irrespective of the size, you would rescale the phenomena so that in the end you have nice proportions in the animal. And that's true of many things. There's another sort of exception to the rule about scaling, which I could say a few words about, and actually is interesting because the concept was actually goes back to the mathematician Turing. So-called Turing patterns involve a slightly more complex set of mechanisms where you have an activator that induces a repressor, plus this activator activates itself. If you add on that the fact that the diffusivity of the receptor of the repressor is greater than that of the activator, you have a very interesting outcome of, but basically when you activate the repressor, it will repress it, but because locally you have this feedback, you can overcome the repression, so keep it stable, the activation. But because the diffusivity of the repressor is greater, you would repress it at a distance. This forms, you know, spacing patterns. It could be pigmentation in animals. I mean, if you Google search, you will find many examples of how Turing patterns seem to apply to, you know, patterning of pigmentations in fish and maybe in other animals. Unfortunately, in zebra, it's difficult to do. But in fact, these systems actually do not scale. And that's probably what you want. You know, you think you have an arm that is slightly bigger than the other ones. You want the spacing of the hairs or whatever is actually conserved because it's a local property. You don't want zebra, you know, to have bigger stripes than small ones because they use actually these actually stripes as a mechanism to protect against, you know, the assault of insects and things like that. So this has no scaling property. This has scaling properties. How they have scaling properties, we don't know. There's debates, many questions around that. Okay? So I've given you already two examples of how you can build simple logics to actually produce patterns out of that. A third example is something which adds to the dimension of space, the dimension of time. During development, the production of the somites, which you saw in the first movie in the zebrafish development, and it's true actually of all vertebrates, and also argued to be true of other animals, is produced by a phenomenon of so-called segmentation clot. So I will just very briefly introduce you this notion. Actually, this was actually theorized by some theorists before the experiments in the 90s actually proved it to be correct. The idea that cells would have an ability to build some kind of oscillatory expression of a gene. Okay. And if they manage to actually synchronize by oscillatory behavior, which they could easily do if they have some mechanisms for coupling chemically whatever endows them with this single oscillatory behavior, then you would synchronize chemically a group of cells in their oscillation. Okay. And for example, if I just represent a vertebrate embryo in chick or zebrafish, this is caudal, this is a posterior if you want, this is the anterior part, and there's going to be molecules that are going to be produced here with sprayed in waves all the way to the anterior and arrive in this region where they will stabilize and control the formation of somites, which are sort of the transient structures that shall prefigure the vertebrae, if you want. Okay? And then, in the meantime, this is growing because you have cell division. So that goes slightly more posterior. Until you have a new wave that sort of is born here and propagates here. Well, the wave is sort of the spatial translation of the oscillatory behavior of these genes, right? So fundamentally, you have a oscillatory network that actually involves some kind of negative feedback in the system with a delay, which, you know, very simply produces an oscillator. These are coupled in ways that are not clear, and the spatial translation of that is actually the propagation of information from posterior to anterior. And each time you have a wave, traveling wave of gene expression, you produce a new vertebra. So in snakes, you have to do it many, many hundred times. In human beings, I can't remember, but a few tens of times. There's very, very precise control over how many times you have to do it, which I will not talk about, but we had people again who worked on that, and we have some lectures in this week again on this topic. This is a very interesting sort of elaboration on the pattern of how you produce information, now couple some oscillatory behavior in space to produce, again, very beautiful spatial patterns. So this is going to be the end of the information part of my lecture. I wanted to convey you with the idea that information is conserved across organisms, and that there is a certain logic in the existence of patterning systems where either you produce morphogens where the gradual decline and continuous decline in the concentration of a molecule is going to partition and discretize the field into distinct domains. And of course, the process could go on and go on again, because the targets, so the genes that form domains, could themselves be the source of a morphogen that would go on and so forth. In a couple of hours, 3 hours of flight development, to give you an idea of the precision of the system, you start with a morphogen that spreads across 0.5 millimeter. Here you're going to have a few hundred cells. And at some point of development, you can use chemical probes which tell you that each cell along the entry of your axis has a unique identity. So the discretization process goes all the way to singularity of cells having a given fate. But more than that, and if you think about, you know, and actually it's known now what difference in molecules are there between two neighboring cells. And it's been argued that the system is close to the optimal precision that you could think of in these systems, but that I will not refine upon. So clearly this gives you the sort of potential power of this system to explain the precision of information. Okay? Yeah, exactly. The molecule of this, so all these, you know, factors, A, repressors, are proteins produced by genes with themselves have feedback on the system by regulating other genes. So initially you have one input, then two outputs, but now two of the outputs become inputs for the next step. So you have this sort of gradual increase in complexity. Now, what these people in flies actually got the Nobel Prize in 95 because they actually found out that the making of a fly in these early steps is down to few tens of genes, not more, say 20, working in hierarchical order. So there is a certain simplicity to what seems to be extremely complicated. And I've given you some other ways of segmenting an embryo back through this oscillatory clock. Some system scales, the others don't, Turing patterns do, don't, etc. So in the remaining of the time I have, I would like to touch upon, and this will be a bit more rapid, what is this information used for? You know, you produce an information, you know that at some point each cell has a unique address, if you will, spatial coordinates. And the remarkable thing is that patterning, in a certain sense, can be viewed as working in two dimension. I'm sort of hiding the fact that, you know, these envelopes, these 2D sheets could be wrapped into spheres or ellipsoids, but in a way the cells don't know that. They live in two dimension and the pattern in two dimension. But of course, in the end, development is in three dimension. So think of origami. You know, origami, there is a sheet and there's an information as to where and when you do a mechanical operation, folding, and we all know that it can be extremely complex. You also know if you try origami that if you mess up by a few percent at some point, you're dead, right? Which gives you an idea of how exquisite and precise information has to be conveyed from step to step in order to prevent these catastrophes. And actually probably suggests that there must be some checkpoints to proofread and correct. And we know that. You could kill cells. You could irradiate flies. What comes out of it is certainly flies whose progeny will have problems because they will have mutations in the germline, but nonetheless their shape is normal. And if you know block in these very irradiated flies cell death, then you have a monster. So the way they correct is by killing the cell that were basically contributing some odd part in development. Okay, so there is maybe some checkpoints. So now I would like to say a few things about the mechanics. This information is used to produce what is an otherwise two-dimensional information deployed in these organisms to produce now the three-dimensional shape of animals. Now I would like to say two things about mechanics. There again, looking at the tremendous diversity of shapes in animals, you could say, well, it's going to be, sure, a common set of information, but the mechanism by which you form these very different animals is going to be all very different. Well, in fact, you could categorize the complexity of animal forms into a subset, actually very limited examples, of morphogenetic processes, that is, how 2D sheets become three-dimensional structures. And I'm going to talk very simply. You could fold a tissue. You know, a tissue, say, the dorsal part of the vertebrates, called the neuroectoderm, has complicated names. It's the precursor of skin and nervous system. You partition nervous system from skin by producing some kind of, so this is, sorry, in three dimension there would be something like this, okay, and I'm just cutting through it. Sure, you see it. So you have kind of an enfolding, kind of a buckling, if you see, of the sheet, right, which form this, and later on you will have a tube, the nervous system, and the skin, right? So how do you form a tube? And this is present in every single organism. It could be single cells, it could be group of cells, it could be a whole part of the tissue. You have to produce a so-called invaginational folding. Another example is elongation. You could elongate a tissue. And actually this happens again in every single organism. So the first business of an embryo is making a long anterior posterior axis, longer than the dorsal ventral axis. So, well, elongate. I could say a few words about that. But if you elongate, there has to be some directional information. What is the axis of elongation? There could also be actually a direction, because the elongation could be just one direction and not the other ones. How do you control this? Well, of course, you might think that all this information that I talked to you about has to have some bearing on that, and it does, right? Well, maybe I would stop there. These are the two most common examples of how you make shape in 3D. Although I should add that this is a view of development that focuses on sheets. But while that explains many developmental processes, there are many other examples of development where actually you have three-dimensional masses of cells that are not organized. And they too can elongate. Of course, they will not form such a thing. So I will present a view of this, which is a little bit biased towards and actually working on slightly simplified systems, which are two-dimensional structures. But there again, here you have the idea that there has to be some information about the directions and the axis, or both. Here there has to be some information as to where you want to fold. You don't want to fold randomly. It has to be very precisely controlled. Okay. So now, so the good news is that there are two general classes. And of course, if you define where and when and in which direction you do these operations, then you could play around with simulations that actually would produce this sort of deformation. You could produce a lot of different shapes, and even more so than origami can, because origami work on only one operation, which is folding. Here you could do much more. So you can imagine that that is enough to explain the whole diversity of cell of tissue shapes. But now you want to know, you know, this is a very cool representation of a tissue. As I said in my introduction, tissues are made of cells. How do cells, having this precise information, actually control these processes? And then thinking about the processes going on there, you have to think there must be some energy that is consumed to actually produce this deformation. There has to be some forces that are actually acting between cells to produce these deformations. And so today, it is possible to actually describe sort of a cellular understanding of how you produce this folding and extension of tissues. And I would say, I mean, we could talk a lot of time, but I have to wrap up in, I guess, 2-3 minutes, right? The important thing is that there's a whole literature studying the processes of development and from the standpoint of these mechanical operations. And maybe I should say a few words about that. You know about Hydra. Hydra, you disaggregate. You can make cells, you know, you have this animal with tentacles. You dissociate the cells, you put them together, and within 2 days, you will regenerate the whole Hydra again. So the cells can actually reorganize a whole animal, although you scramble completely the information. Now, you could also take cells the experiment go back in the 50s from a guy called Altretter, that actually took cells of the ectoderm and the mesoderm, which are precursor of skin and muscles. He dissociated the cells, mixed them together in a bowl where they, so there would be black cells and white cells, completely salt and pepper. I will stop the drawing there, with salt and pepper. Within a few hours, 12 hours, he saw that the skin cell would be on the periphery. Of course, this is not an organism, but it shows an ability of sorting of the cells. And of course, so these are experiments from Olfretter in the 50s. And there's a guy called Steinberg, Max Steinberg, in the 60s and 70s, actually proposed a simple idea where actually the cells would not do migration and so being attracted by neighbors, producing information, so-called chemotaxis, which Olfretter thought. But he said, you know, maybe it's a simple contact information. There would be cells that have a stronger adhesivity to the neighbors. They would stick more to the neighbors than the other ones. At the time, there was no knowledge of what these adhesion molecules were. It was just a simple hypothesis. And he proposed as differential affinities, which he first coined, and then adhesivities, when the molecules were known, would be responsible for the gradual sorting, because cells explore randomly some path, they aggregate, they have different energy of contact. And today you can describe this very faithfully by modeling the, having thermodynamic models of the process by saying, you know, there's going to be an energy cost to making an interface. And if I say that the molecules regulate that by their binding properties, then I could do this sorting phenomenon like oil and vinegar. So that has proven to be true to some extent, and is still actually very an important idea today. Okay. And at the corollary of that, these experiments suggested the notions popularized by Steinberg that on long time scales, these cells in spheres are like fluids which diffuse around, the diffusivity depending on the frictions with the neighbors, addition properties, and until they find some kind of optimal configuration which would reflect some kind of local energy minimum. What this, and this had a major impact in development in the 90s. People like Takeuchi, Edelman, who got the Nobel Prize for the discovery of immunoglobulins, thought and conceptualized models of development based on adhesion properties, telling cells where and when they have to do their business of aggregating, forming the neural tube, which I've erased, or is still here. And this was a very adhesion-centric view of development, which you can still find in reviews in the 90s, right? But what has become, I think, a major step in the analysis of development in the past 15 years is the notion that actually these processes, fluid behavior of tissues actually are dependent on active forces produced and transmitted by cells and between cells to actually control their motility or even control the very movement. So in other words, there was nothing, not such a thing as sort of a passive sort of temperature. So the noise here could be done by temperature in simulations. But in vivo, you know, this noise is actually controlled by the energy produced by cells using contractility, right? And I will finish with sort of a 1-2 minute statement saying that, and I will not go into the details, I think the important new notion today is that this sorting phenomenon, these organizing properties that actually underlie these active processes actually is controlled not by simple adhesive processes, however important they are to keep the cohesion of all of these tissues, but by active forces producing cells. So just a few words about these forces, because you may say, what are they? How do you produce forces in cells? Well, you start with molecules, and actually last week or 2 weeks ago, we had one of the co-discoverers of the so-called motors, molecular motors in biology. So these motors are actually molecules which have these amazing properties of, so they have a head, it's like a foot, in fact, and they walk on a scaffold of so-called filaments. These filaments are called microfilaments or actin in one case. These are actually what underlie actually contraction of long muscles, okay? And so they work on these polymers. These polymers are turning over, they are complex gels, but they have these motors that can be organized in complex ways, and through the hydrolysis of ATP, sort of the most important molecule in biology, because actually through the hydrolysis of ATP, you produce the energy that is then mechanically transduced to produce the movement on this filament. So you work on filaments, and by pulling many filaments every second, or fraction of a second, you could actually, and using adequate cross-linkers, you could produce stress. And so to recap, you see how force can be produced. This force will have no impact in cells. If you take a cell, we'll have like springs to simplify what could be the effective result of a tension that you generate in the cells. And I'm going to simplify it. You're going to have a certain spring. And the cell will have also, and this will be connected to the edges of the cells. And by virtue of their ability to connect to the sides, well, they could effectively transduce the contraction of this network into the contraction of the cell, right? And if the cells are connecting to the neighbors because they stick to each other, then you can imagine that you could begin to think about how the ways in which you can organize tension, spatially and temporally in tissues. So now we find phenomena such as contraction is not static in some cases, it's actually going into pulses of contraction and vanishes and goes again, as if you had a pacemaker for the force, that's temporal dynamics. You also have phenomena of directional stress being controlled in tissues, which say, well, here I'm going to produce a major stress to actually reassort cells together so that they converge this way and the tissue extend that way. You can make force to actually say, here I'm going to have some movement like plaques that converge, and then you produce some buckling and do things. So, you know, you could elaborate as you wish. But today we can have a pretty accurate quantitative understanding of morphogenesis based on production of stress by motors. And here we have specialists to understand, you know, sort of the underlying theory of how you produce, how these motors work on networks, how stress can be locally organized in cells with a given polarity. You can break the symmetry in cells, like one cell is going to have something there and not on the other side, and how by proxy you organize tissues, eventually you actually produce this very deformation. If you break symmetry, in biology we say you polarize the structure, and there's a great deal of information. That is the most important information that goes from gene expression, which I talked in the first half, gives rise to symmetry breaking information at a single cell level, is going to be sort of lined up across the whole tissue to control force and motility. So one important and sort of open question is how the information laid down at genetic level is giving rise to symmetry breaking phenomena at the cellular and tissue levels. But you see now, maybe you have sort of a flavor of how we can crack some important aspects of development by understanding how information is laid down progressively to single cells, while you start with a single large tissue or a single cell, and how it then speaks to local cells to produce force, which are going to be resisted by adhesion properties. I will stop there. There are many challenges for the future, and one of them being understanding how growth is being controlled. You know, I know I didn't talk about that, except that I said that we have a finite size and we also have proportions. Our left and right lengths are more or less similar. And that is one of the big open questions in development. And I will stop there and take any further questions.
First of all, I'll take the prerogative of the first question. So you mentioned buckling, and that's sort of what was going through my head as you started talking about symmetry breaking.
Yeah.
And buckling, you know, the standard column problem, of course, that chooses a wave number, which is the longest wavelength you can get in the column, but the direction of it is unchosen.
Right.
Other than some
right.
Stability?
Right. So the thing is that in an embryo, in a tissue, there's always kind of a history. You never start from scratch. Even, you know, the polarity of the egg, the first symmetry breaking, comes from the polarity of the mother. And maybe, you know, a million years ago, there was a polarity event randomly propagating through all animals. So I think it has an important aspect here. An egg is going to have an outside and an inside. And if you have a tissue that is under compressive forces, potentially it could buckle either direction, which I think was your question. Well, here there's going to be an envelope always that protects the animal against many things and actually effectively produces some kind of constraints and pressure, which effectively will prevent any outward buckling. And there are experiments shown where a buckling occurs. If you make a tiny hole in this, then you would block it. So you need some pressure to actually produce the effective buckling and that prevent it from out. And I think in all instances, you can more or less sort of understand the direction edge of the buckling based on the configuration.
But I guess a more quantifying question.
Right.
So is it the case that some of these can actually be explained mechanically? As you can understand it quantitatively, that it reached the limit to put in a buckle or not, or is that still limit?
There are specialists and theorists of buckling. I'm not. I think my understanding, talking with these people, is that it's pretty hard to come up with. But maybe Vincent or Boris or Jacques could say a word about that.
Edward produced all the shapes of the intestinal villi and all the patterns, but with this kind of vacuumed ideas. But it's not proof that's what really happens, and we don't have that proof yet.
But,
How do you imagine evolution? One could imagine there are even schemes that are sometimes activated and change something, or it's a failure of existing schemes that you describe.
So I think it's important to think about evolution. I think when underlying the biologic, you know, the logic is sort of the dream that there are principles, something general. And I think that this is a bit hand-waving. If there was a way to test it, you would like to test to replay the game second time or three times. Well, the thing is that you could sort of do it by comparing plants or fungi and animals, because there the multicellularity was invented independently. And of course, you know, the outcome are complex organisms which have prevailed over many million years. And it would be very interesting to actually compare strategies by looking at animal and plants. Of course, there is a fundamental difference. In animals, cells move, in plants, they don't. So that imposes major constraints. But looking at how you break symmetry, the underlying logic is interesting, because this sort of polarity phenomena that, you know, you need to. And actually in plants, although we don't know well the mechanisms, there's planar polarity to do many things. How you subdivide from a homogeneous field discrete domains, there again this occurs. How does it work? So that's one way of exploring and answering the question. But otherwise, I think there's a lot of contingencies, and you have to just accept that, you know, just like also in the history of the universe, maybe you could argue, maybe, that there are contingencies that, you know, from initial conditions sort of unfolds. And can you change it? Maybe we'll have the answer next week.
I want to come back to your tadpole experiment, the two-headed tadpole.
It's not mine, but I'm...
That description. So instead of taking that self, is there some transposition that you can do that would give you the fat tadpole, that wouldn't give the elongated tail, but would change the vertical versus horizontal axis ratio?
So instead of making a new anterior-posterior animal, you would make... fatter.
Yeah. No, a squeeze in. So it's like making a human being.
Right.
With, instead of the height being right, the longer scale.
It's a very interesting question. I think it tells you something about what I left open in the end is growth. You know, I describe development in a way in a qualitative phenomenon. But there's issue of growth, how much you grow. Now, growth is interesting because it actually is not just how much you do something, which is mass increase with a certain rate. There's also directionality, because when cells, remember my first movie, cells divide, and you have one and then two. Depending on how you orient that, well, you will have a certain directionality. So you could actually, and actually there are models of how you regulate the size and with respect to shape, which I think is your question, the interplay between how much and in which direction, by explaining how directionality of growth occurs, directionality of cell division. And there again, you know, planar cell, this mechanism of polarity can feed on the orientation of the cell division. Okay. Now, that did not address your question specifically in the case of the frog, but I know nothing about the details of the experiments. I think it would be right to ask people. I also anticipate the answer is fairly complex because this is a late stage of development. There are many things going on. But I think it's true that when thinking about growth and how some group of cells can reorganize the neighbors, they not only have to organize identity, they also have to have an impact on growth, how much you grow, with a certain directionality. Otherwise, you will end up with a fat, you know, unproportioned other animal. And when you do these experiments, you keep having the sort of same nice elongated structure. So growth...
Some kind of energy conservation argument, do you think?
I think you have to have a... I don't know. Well, it's going to use the energy that is in the egg to do all of its business. Right? Or from the mother. So you could isolate the system as you wish. There would be conservation of energy, but otherwise it's sort of self-organized. Yes?
What happens if you reduce the amount of energy available? So if you diminish the size of the egg by
right,
half, how does development play out? Where is the impact?
Well, you know, you could take flies, don't feed them, be nasty with them, you'll have tiny flies, just perfectly shaped. You could feed them a bit more, it would be slightly bigger. You could play around with pathways. What we call pathways are actually information flows exchanged by cells talking to the gene makeup to actually control how much they grow. And they will make bigger animals. You can even do something better. You make a group of cells think that, well, actually eating more, getting more energy, they will be bigger than the neighbors, okay? And they will contribute a bigger structure because, you know, the pathway, the whole system is being flawed. But the answer is that the system are very tolerant to food, how much energy. And that's probably what has been selected in evolution, you know, of course, you know, depending on temperature, depending on prey and all of that, you know, you might have to go through development irrespective of how big you are.
Is there a limit, like if you reduce...
Yes, there is a limit.
So like 1% yolk in the trunk case, like...
It's, I mean, the variation in size that I have in mind in flies is could be up to 20-30% difference. It's very big. It's visible. Also, females are bigger than males in flies, in many animals actually, at least insects.
It's like 2 hours.
Yeah.
Remind you, why did you start?